Actually talking about programs.
Am I relaxing?
Yeah. Hey, Bill, check it out.
Well, I just have to.
There's numbers.
No, I'm kidding. I brought it on a flash drive. Oh, you were in there.
It's all good. Fred brought some Kentucky.
How's Kentucky?
No, it's lunchtime.
Super sad, right? Thank God their team lost in the
semifinals. Yeah, they're chirping.
Because they rioted.
Subcommittee on Human Services, April 9th, 2015. Eric, are we on?
Yes.
Okay. This public hearing on Senate Bill 5526. We're going to try to wrap up shared services this morning and move on to Department of Human Services if we have a chance.
And the other bill, too.
And the other bill is House Bill 5026, DHS. And we'll move from one to the other, hopefully, seamlessly. Famous last words. So please present yourself to the committee, and we'll go from there. Kate, are you feeling better?
Much better.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Scherzinger, Chief Operating Officer of the Department of Human Services.
And I'm Suzanne Hoffman, Chief Operating Officer for the Oregon Health Authority.
And for the record, Kate Nass with Department of Administrative Services, Chief Financial Office.
So we finished yesterday we're in the middle of shared services and walking through them sort of in order of their cost. We have, I think, five slides left to go, so, and I know you want to get onto IT, which is a little more interesting, so we'll try to move through this.
Was that sarcasm?
Actually, I think imaging is interesting, but the Imaging and Records Management Office, their basic function is to convert paper applications into electronic documents, and they do it mostly through key punch, some amount of character recognition, and then they install and support electronic workflow for programs. And you see some of the benefits of what they do. What we tried to illustrate is sort of the interesting struggle we have with how we use this technology. On the one hand, it really improves the efficiency of our operations if we're receiving paper applications. But on the other side, we're better off in the long run to not receive applications in paper, but instead to have more electronic means of applying for both from the applicant's point of view, and if somebody walks into an office and we have somebody help them, for them to enter it into an electronic system rather than start with paper in the long run is a better way to go. But the trade-off we have is that we know that we're working on those systems, but until those get in place, in fact, we have to process a lot of paper. And sort of knowing what that demand is depends to some extent on how quickly we're able to install to move away from this kind of technology into the more electronic ways of doing applications in the first place. And recently, of course, this office has been an important part of not only the hybrid process for Medicaid applications, but also our efforts within our local field offices to move to more paperless workflow and what we call EDMS. And so the struggle we have as a shared service is that we've had a huge increase in the number of pages we're processing through this office. And we haven't had enough permanent positions to do this, so we've hired people beyond the number of permanent positions we have, just because the alternatives are so. And so we've had to move resources into this office because the inefficiency of not processing them through here, instead sending them to program and have them put them in, is way worse than trying to get a little more resources into here to process the paper. But in the long run, the goal, like I say, is to automate eligibility, and at some point in the future, hopefully, we don't need anywhere near this level of functionality in the shared service. So that's kind of where we are with this office. And we've sort of shown that on the graph that we've that's sitting there in front of you.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
So I'm just wondering if you could define, in the long run, you want everyone to get to electronic. What are you thinking, 1 year, 3 years?
Well, certainly not 1 year, and probably not even 3 years. It's a long-term effort to do this, and we haven't been as successful as we would want to have been in doing this. So I think that's like the $64,000 question, mm-hmm. or probably a bigger dollar amount than that, but
so, yeah, 64,000 would be nice. So the march to Kentucky, we're thinking February.
Is that?
We're still on target for that.
Well, they'll talk. That's what they'll get to later today. How about that?
Okay, and maybe we'll get to that later also when we talk about shared services that DHS caseworkers would like to see them being able to again sign up people to Medicaid. As part of the screen. Right. So was that part of the discussion later this morning?
I don't know.
Or was it right now?
Do you want me to respond? Committee for the Record again. Suzanne Hoffman, Chief Operating Officer for the Oregon Health Authority. I think in the IT presentation you're going to hear next, Sarah Miller and Kristen Deuce will be able to speak to what the functionality will be in February 2016 and then what some of those future enhancements can be to the system, including what will be available to workers in field offices.
Just so you know, you may be aware of this, and I don't want to repeat things you've already heard. A decision was made to stop DHS workers from being allowed to sign people up for Medicaid for health insurance. Took it off their screen, can't do it. They've got clunky systems anyway. The idea being that we'd have one central place to sign up people for the Medicaid and for
exchange.
Called Cover Oregon.
Exchange.
You may remember that little nightmare, which is fading from our memories quickly, I hope. But the decision to not have DHS workers sign up, I think, was, in my opinion only, not the right one to make. Others would disagree with that. But we need we need all hands on deck for this kind of a situation, especially with the ACA. And now to go back and retrain people and get that back on their screens is not going to be an easy trick. We understand that, but I think that's where we should go. And I don't know if the Kentucky plan allows that or not. We'll probably find out in a few minutes. So I'll stop there. And Jim, do you want to continue?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I wanted to follow up on what you just explained to us. Are these instances where a DHS worker was already working with somebody and then they had to hand them off to, you know, tell them to go call someone else?
I may be correct in what I'm going to say. DHS workers, which there's a large number of caseworkers, people, the idea is you walk in one door for services. I don't care if it's TANF or it's SNAP or whatever you want. or Medicaid, whatever you qualify for, you get in one door. And a decision was made to cut Medicaid off of that.
That was exactly why I was asking. Thank you. So someone is already talking to a caseworker, and now they're referred to yet
somebody
another
else
person.
Medicaid.
Okay. Thank you.
Am I going to be corrected in that, or is that correct?
Yeah, I think you're correct.
You're correct.
Thank you.
How do you make a frowny face?
Well, you know, it's interesting how things.
The one door concept. Yeah.
So the next page, the next slide, is as we move down through the shared services, is contracts and procurement.
That's our dream.
And the functions that they perform is are listed there: coordinating purchases of goods, issuing solicitations, executing contracts, intergovernmental agreements, oversight of the program contracts, the training of contract managers, contract maintenance, and a few statistics. They sort of manage over 12 billion, or 10 at any one time, about 10 billion. In contracts between the two agencies. We did put one statistic that they follow as part of their metrics is how long it takes, sort of median days it takes to process an action by various categories of agreements. And so you can sort of look at that and both get a sense of the kinds of agreements they work on and how they follow, how long it takes to work through them. The next office is OAPI, which is the Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations. Actually, I think I may have gotten these two slides out of order. You've actually seen these two slides before with the APD. In the APD presentation, this office has two major functions. One is to do actual investigations of some allegations of adult abuse, particularly of our employees in many cases. But also, they oversee the whole process of adult protective services over the state, and that. Their actual investigations are done all through the state at different levels of allegations of adult abuse, and they oversee that process. And so you saw that discussed in the program discussion with APD, and you saw these slides in that process, and you see some statistics about the growth in the number of allegations and the work that they've done statewide to try to reduce the number of investigations that were running late to get investigations done more timely within the statutes. And then on the next chart is sort of talks about the system itself, what is adult abuse, and how the system works from a very high level. And then the next slide takes all the other shared services that are on the DHS side and just says what they do. There is, and it's again sort of in the, or it's in the order of their budgets. The budget center, each of the two agencies has their own budget office that are in their central services. Those are the people that have that come to you and help present the budget with you, Eric, and his staff. But there's also a central unit that does the technical work of working with PICS and Orbitz and making sure that we balance and our entries are put in there appropriately. That's a shared service. Then there we have a facilities office, a joint facilities office that helps manage all the lease property that we have and works with DAS on the new state brokerage process and processes all the payments that go to the landlords on our lease property and works with the landlords on maintenance and improvements and the whole accounting of that process. They also coordinate vehicle usage of the two agencies, and they work on when we have relocations and managing moves. We also have, as a shared service, the forecasting and research analysis. They do the client caseload forecasts, which is obviously a critical budget driver for both agencies. They operate some advisory committees, both internal and external, on that forecast because it is so important. And they do cross-program analysis. They maintain a database that goes into each of our program databases and tries to build a picture. And I think you've seen bubble charts in here. They are the ones that create that bubble chart that says that we have clients that are served by these four programs. That's part of what they do. They maintain that database. We have a publications and design unit that does desktop publishing for the two agencies, and they also work on translations and alternative formats for people that need that service of our publications. We have a performance excellence office that was it's actually this is an area that we've repurposed to really support some critical needs. They're really important in helping on the hybrid process of processing Medicaid applications. And this office has really been reduced a lot since when we've had to take budget reductions. It's been reduced a lot in the last 4 years. Just because that's where we've had to take reductions. Then we also have an internal audit function that's joint. They really do three things. They do internal audits based on what our joint audit committee, how they prioritize what needs to be done. They do coordination of external audits, and that's a huge role for them because we're at any one time if you look at the list of audits that we're subject to at any one time, it's a pretty long list. And so they coordinate both with the Secretary of State on their audits as well as many of the federal reviews that we're under and whatever other miscellaneous ones are come to our door. And then they do consultations with offices about how to improve their operations when we've had audit findings, and they run our risk management process. And then we have a couple people in the what you might call the administration section that oversees this. I guess the only thing I would add, and you really see this back with imaging, is that it came up yesterday that that OPAR in particular produces revenue. And that it's sort of different than these other offices. I actually think of it that in many of these other offices, what we're trying to do with them is to put services and have them do services that really save the agency's money. And that's kind of the way we think about it. So imaging, for an example, if we didn't do it there, it would be more expensive to do it other places. If you look at any one of our business systems, the work is happening in those systems, both out in the agency, in the front lines, so in HR, the hiring manager, all the way up into the HR office that each agency has, and then back into the technical aspects that are shared services. That if many times putting money into the shared service can save you money out in the field, and that's the way we ought to think about it. And that's what we're trying to do with these shared services, and that's why we have the customers that really drive that service. I'm just saying that's the way we should think about this, and that's what we try to do. The last piece is a list of the POPs that are relative to Central and Shared Services. I know you're going to have a much more detailed presentation on POPs in a couple weeks, so I don't know how much you want to go through in these now. I guess maybe it's just a question of time, how you want to spend your
time. We've got about 5 more minutes for you. How many slides you got left?
This is the last one.
So. Why don't you run through this real quickly, and we can come back to it later again also.
So the three that are on here that are relative to central and shared services are the RealD IT project, which is the one that implements House Bill 2134 that says we need to gather more consistent and more complete information about the ethnicity, the language, and the disability information of our clients. And this is the POP that would help build the IT system to do that. The second is a TANF investigator POP in OPAR that I guess beefs up the fraud investigations and to take the backlog work down. And then the last one is two other IT projects. And I think this, you'll also cover this, it says tomorrow, but now that's today. The non-Magi eligibility automation project and the adult protective services system. To build a system that tracks investigations of adult abuse.
Senator Winters.
Question on your POPs, and go back to number one, and in fact, in all of them, you can respond. I notice that you have your FTEs. Are those permanent, and why are they not limited duration? You know, with some projects, when you start in startup, particularly if you're talking about, you know, trying to gather certain information that will be used longitudinal, but you will not need that many bodies. To continue it on, can you kind of help me understand whether you're talking limited duration, temporary, part-time, and all of those questions? It makes a difference in funding.
So Senator Winters, co-chairs, members of the committee, I don't know specifically.
It's on my desk.
What?
It's on my desk.
On her desk. Okay. I don't know specifically where those are on these particular pops.
Let's hold off for IT. They're coming up next.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Number two, the investigator positions. We've had a little bit of discussion on a previous day in this committee about the... there are at least two areas where there are people who investigate things. One is sort of a quality control area, and another is more directly some fraud or some other kind of investigation. Can you explain? And apparently the people who work in those two different areas have different powers of authority to either look into things or to stop benefits if they're being inappropriately used. So can you explain the difference between those two areas and what this number two is about, and why you would recommend people in one versus the other area?
So Co-Chair Nathanson, co-chairs, members of the committee, so this question came up last time on those two different authorities, and one of them is the fraud investigator and the other is the QC reviewer. So the QC function, the quality control function, it's like an audit. They go out and they look at cases and they ask the question, is this all the work appropriately done? Is it documented appropriately? Did the person who get the benefit get an appropriate benefit? And in the process of doing that work, that person has, because part in many cases they're actually would be talking to the or getting information from the person who got the benefit. They have the ability to suspend benefits if the person isn't responding to their requests. And it's very rarely used, but they do have that power. If a case is referred to the fraud investigators within OPAR, that person doesn't have that authority. And as I understand it, that's a federal requirement because they believe that it gives too much power to the investigator to sort of, I don't know what, to makes it too heavy-handed, I guess might be the way to say that. And I think that's the question that came up, is that differential authority. That doesn't mean that, though, that if the person is not eligible for those benefits, that nobody can take that benefit away. The actual case manager out in the field can do that. All this prohibition is you can't do it because the person is not responding to you. If there's evidence that says that person isn't eligible, the field can still take that benefits away. So yesterday, Representative Olson asked about that specifically, about how well that process works. And so, and how effective are we in that situation of being sure the field acts on that? Mm-hmm. And that's the thing we agreed with him. We would sit down and walk through that.
So I guess to follow up then on this particular policy option package, this is to reduce a backlog, it says.
Right.
Which backlog is this? And is there a backlog in the field?
This is backlog in OPAR around TANF specifically.
Okay.
Whereas I think the questions that came up yesterday were broader than just one program.
Okay.
It's sort of how the whole process would work. Okay.
That's enough for right now. Thank you.
And Jim, offline, I'd like to hear about what you mean by increased safety to workers who often work in clients' homes. I want to hear about that later.
Okay.
That's a concerning phrase. It means there's something behind it. I'd like to hear about that later. Okay. Thank you for your presentation.
Thanks.
I think you're clear for today, and we'll be seeing you later, I'm sure. And I'm going to ask IT to come up.
Can you swap me chairs over there?
How do you do this?
Yesterday it was my computer.
Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record.
Are you from IT?
I am, in fact, from IT. But I am relieved to know that Representative Nathanson's computer had an issue yesterday when I was not in the room, so it cannot be associated with my presence. So this caused the problem today. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Miller, and since January of 2015, I have been the Chief Operating Officer for Technology for the Department of Human Services. I also need to tell you that I serve a dual role. So I am also the Magi Medicaid System Transfer Project Director, which is a position with the Oregon Health Authority. And so the previous references to the march to Kentucky are a project that I'm responsible for. I'll try to be really clear for you today when I'm talking with my DHS hat on as compared to my OHA hat. So for most of what I'll do initially, I'm talking from my position as Chief Operating Officer for Technology for the Department of Human Services.
So Sarah, two things real quick. One, I'd like to take just a moment. I know it's probably the end of your situation or your presentation, but Senator Winters asked a question that you heard already about temporary positions versus permanent positions. Let's answer that first, okay? We went in and explain to us all carefully what MAGI is again.
Be happy to.
Senator Winters' questions first, please.
Co-Chair Bates, Senator Winters, you asked a question about the use of limited duration positions for projects, particularly technology-related projects. And the answer relative to both departments' policy option packages are it varies. So when we're doing a project, you're right, there is frequently work that is one-time initial setup work. We use limited duration positions to do that work because it is not ongoing. But you asked the question about the REAL plus D policy option package that supports both agencies. And those positions in the both agencies' policy option packages are permanent positions because sometimes technology enables program in a way that takes ongoing resources to do work. And the blend of positions relative to the REAL plus DPOP is not just technology-related folks. There are people who will work in the Office of Information Services that have to support the back-end technology that is enabled by that project. But more importantly, in the Office of Equity and Inclusion in the Oregon Health Authority and the Office of Equity and Minority Multicultural Services. Sorry, I'm learning my new agency's acronyms. The program areas that that policy option package supports need people on the business side to do the policy work, to set the data standards that will be implemented for all systems. And so the particular piece of legislation that this body passed to create that effort requires both agencies to work to remediate all of their IT systems, to gather the same data elements for this particular category, race, ethnicity, language, and disability where it's appropriate across all its IT systems. And so that is a multi-biennia effort that will have ongoing work in order to utilize the data that we will gather in a way that we can report it to the body. And so in the case of that particular POP, most of the positions are not limited duration.
I guess I'm wrestling with the notion that once you collect and you get systems in place and you do the survey and you discern the language issues, that it goes on infinitum.
Co-Chair Bates, Senator Winters, I understand the question that you have, and it's difficult to anticipate the exact body of work, except to know that every time we make data available, then people have additional questions and flavors that they want. So here's part of the work that those people will do, right? For the Oregon Health Authority, it is about health disparities associated with, you know, particular ethnicities. Well, once I generate a report and give that data to everybody, there has to be people actually working on what are the right strategies to meet those disparities. Are the health strategies
maybe I'll put my question another way. Is the same number of bodies needed to begin the project in order to get it where you need to go, and also the same body number in order to do the follow-up? I'm sitting here, and I've been around here a long time, and I'm sitting here just trying in my own mind to grasp that it does take that kind of continuum.
What we commonly see here is the program gets started up, you hire a bunch of people to start the program, and once the program's running and the lower number would be needed to maintain it, that never happens.
It never happens.
That's the real question.
Co-Chair Bates, Senator Winters, I'd appreciate the opportunity to have follow-up on this conversation for two reasons. I don't think we all have the same shared understanding about what the work is. And when we come back to have detailed conversation about these POPs for both agencies, we'd be happy to be more specific about what that work is. But frankly, you know, in large-scale information technology projects, we also don't serve the state well by using only limited duration people positions to hire people. People want job security. They want to understand that they have a skill set that can be applied appropriately. And so we frequently have, in technology projects in particular, failed recruitments for skilled people to do this work. And so I believe it is the priority of this body to make sure that agencies like my agency deliver technology projects appropriately. And it is my professional opinion that the use of limited duration positions makes that more difficult.
Can I follow up question, Mr. Chair?
Absolutely.
In a limited resource environment, and you had to do some puts and takes and to set some priorities, would you still have that same desire to go forward if you could not get the full loaf of bread?
Co-Chair Bates, Senator Winters, in fact, I expect that all asks are puts and takes, and that we have to have a joint conversation about what's most important, both for this body to prioritize investments and for the receiving agencies to make sure that the investments you prioritize, we can actually deliver appropriately. And so I think that that is a conversation that we should have about each and every investment, particularly as it relates to technology projects. And There is definitely a middle ground. You shouldn't give us everything we ask for, and we as the implementers should say to you that there are some things that we know that we need to make the project be successful, and I would hope you would be receptive to those conversations.
We've got to get through some slides here. I'm going to ask that you discuss this further with Dr. Winters, Senator Winters, when she has a chance.
Co-Chair Bates, Senator Winters.
I'm also going to ask that this is something LFO looks at for us.
Yeah.
And LFO needs to get involved in this discussion also, especially our technology people at LFO.
Co-Chair Bates, we're already having those conversations with your professional staff, both Ms. Byerly, Ms. Ames, and your technology staff. So no problem.
Yeah, I think Mr. Cummings will probably be looking at to help us out here too also. So
I'm spending quality time with Mr. Cummings these days.
We will look forward to that results of his discussion with you.
Great. So you also, Co-Chair Bates, asked me to define MAGI Medicaid.
Yeah.
MAGI stands for Modified Adjusted Gross Income. Which is Medicaid that is provided to Oregonians based on their income status and for no other reason than the income that they have. So usually our most frail population, our lowest income population, the people most in need of safety net services are eligible for MAGI Medicaid.
Could you please repeat that? I'm sorry. I'm trying to write it as you say it.
MAGI, Modified Adjusted Gross Income, which is the type of federal Medicaid that is only income-based. So you have to be below a certain federal poverty level to be eligible for benefits. So it's generally, by definition, our most frail population, our lowest income population, people most in need of safety net services.
Thank you.
There are other Medicaid programs that you get which are not based on your income status, and we call those non-MAGI programs. Okay, I'm going to try and go fast, catch up. So in my role as a COO for technology for the Department of Human Services, I'm a direct report to Director Aaron Kelly Seal. I have three jobs. First, I'm an IT expert, and I advise the five DHS program directors about their efforts to do technology projects in their area. Secondly, I perform a vendor management role for the department. So I have responsibility in working with Office of Information Services as a service provider internal to DHS and also to do vendor management of external contractors on large-scale projects. And then for a limited number of DHS projects, I act in a governance role as either the project sponsor or a steering committee member. What I am not is the department's chief information officer. In fact, here at the table with me, Kristen Deuce, who acts as the CIO for both DHS and OHA, and I'll let her introduce herself.
Good morning. Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee, my name is Kristen Deuce, for the record. I am the Chief Information Officer for both the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority. Sarah and I are pleased to be here today to share some information about the Office of Information Services. You'll also hear us refer to it as OIS. This is the shared services organization providing technology services to both agencies. Up here on the slide, we have the topics that we're going to cover with you today. We're going to share a little bit of information about what it means to be a shared services organization. We'll share a little bit of information about OIS itself, how we're organized, a little bit of information about our budget, and then we're going to talk about some of the challenges and the opportunities that we have in our daily work. Last on the agenda today is we're going to share some information about the IT investments for the 2015-2017 biennium. So with that, Sarah's going to get us started.
As you've heard for the past several weeks from both agencies, they have well-defined missions. You can see on the left for the Department of Human Services, it's safety, health, and independence for all Oregonians. On the right, for OHA, it's the triple aim, right? Better care at a lower cost, creating better health for Oregonians. As a shared service, though, one thing has remained solid. OIS's mission is to provide technology solutions that enable the business objectives of both agencies. And we start from this perspective, as Kristen said, so that you have an understanding that both agencies consider OIS an important service provider. And our collective vision is that they'll excel in customer service meeting business objectives. As you can see from this slide, together, DHS and OHA have more than almost 12,000 employees across 184 office locations. There are hundreds of systems. In child welfare, we call it ORCIDS. In voc rehab, it's ORCA. We use Oregon Access for aging and people with disabilities. We use CAP-CAPI and the mainframe for self-sufficiency programs. On the OHA side, there is the MMIS, or the behavioral health system is supporting addictions and mental health. With the recent changes in leadership, a new OHA director, my role at the Department of Human Services, and a new chief operating officer for OIS, there is a new or renewed strong commitment to partnership between both agencies, business areas, and OIS. Kristen sits on the agency leadership teams for both the Department of Human Services and OHA, and we work together closely to address issues as they arise, but more importantly, I think, to you and to us, to be proactive about preventing issues before they occur. This slide represents the OIS budget in the 15-17 governor's budget. I need to sort of give you some footnotes, though. In order to understand these numbers, please know that IT projects for both agencies are paid out of the program budgets for Department of Human Services and for the Oregon Health Authority. So these numbers do not include IT project investments. Also excluded from this particular budget are charges associated with services from the state data center or other central assessments in support of technology. The largest portion of the OIS budget is personal services associated with the 460 FTE, 469 positions. In June of 2013, both DHS and OHA partnered in the development of a strategic technology plan. You can see in the box on the left a number of business needs that were identified so that OIS, our IT service provider, could develop a plan to address and enable those business needs to be met.
As a part of the strategic planning process, we identified five strategies, and those are the boxes that you see on the right, so that we can keep these in mind as we're building new systems and we're making our priority decisions to make sure that we're addressing the needs that were identified by the business units on the left-hand side of this slide. And I'm going to refer back to this as we go a little bit further in the presentation. With this next slide, what we're trying to depict here is one of our biggest challenges, which is really that of balancing the work of maintaining and operating our current legacy systems with that of carving out time for the new work. And when I'm talking about new work, I'm really talking about those things that were on the right-hand side of the previous slide, around our strategic technology plan. So it's how do we get to the place where we can be modernizing our systems, providing integrated systems, interoperability, all those things that I think you and all of us would like to get to. Over the past several weeks, you have heard from the DHS and OHA agency directors, Aaron Kelly Seal and Lynn Saxton, and many of the program managers about the important work that these two agencies do. Everything from the population-based services, like making sure our drinking water is safe for all Oregonians and performing newborn screening, to the important benefits and services that are provided by the Department of Human Services. Underlying all of these programs is the work of OIS. For over 40 years, we've been building and buying systems to support these programs that you've learned about. In many instances, maybe even most instances, we've been building and buying these systems to meet an immediate need, and we haven't been thinking about the bigger picture. There's many reasons for this. Sometimes it's the funding streams that really narrow our focus. Sometimes it's mandated timelines. Often it's the technology. Over 40 years, technology has changed, and that technology at certain times is very limiting. Today, the Office of Information Systems maintains and supports over 300 systems, many that are 10, 15, 20, and 40 years old. They're built in a myriad of programming languages, from COBOL to ColdFusion, from PowerBuilder to C++, and from .NET to Java. We can question why these systems still exist. We know they don't meet our needs. We know that they're not flexible. We know that they're not integrated or interoperable. We have challenges extracting data from them, and we often have a hard time finding staff that have the skills to maintain them. But there's a reason that these systems still exist. They're complex. The business rules are often coded into the code itself, and most don't come with instruction manuals. It's expensive and time-consuming to replace legacy systems. It's a bit like being a homeowner for a 100-year-old house. Let's say you just bought a new house. It's charming. It's got a lot of charm. And you decide you need air conditioning. You went to the local home show this weekend. You talked to a salesman, and they told you that for $5,000 and a couple weeks of work, you should be able to get air conditioning. You come to me as your contractor and say, I want air conditioning. I have $5,000 in 2 weeks. Please do the work. I'm the one that now has to tell you that your very charming 100-year-old home does not have the ductwork for air conditioning. We agree to a modified timeline, a little bit more money, and we start doing the work. Now I find that there's asbestos in your ceiling tiles and lead paint in your walls. We use technology every day. Here's what I've used so far today. I went running this morning and I used my Shuffle. I texted my niece on my personal iPhone. I played Words with Friends with my mother using my iPad. I did a few emails using my personal laptop. I checked in with Sarah this morning on my work iPhone, and I did a few emails using my work laptop. Wow. Now, maybe that's a little bit extreme for somebody by 9 o'clock a.m., but I'm a pretty early bird. So maybe that's not exactly representative, but I think it is representative of the expectations of people today of our technology. New state and federal legislation, mandates, policies and rules, the need for big data, the need for mobile applications and remote access, increasing demands for security and privacy, holistic service approaches, one-stop shopping, one front door, and self-service portals. All of these require changes to our existing systems if we're going to do them today.
Senator Winters.
Mr. Chair, I just can't. I'm about to go crazy. And I'm about to go crazy because one-stop shop has been the golden vision since 1969. One-stop shop, and I'm kind of sitting here listening as though sometime it's a new thing, but it's not. I'm sitting here also thinking, Mr. Chairs, that perhaps because the discussion this morning is some of the same discussions that we've had, I know as long as I've been on this panel, about the inadequacy and the complication and all the things that are currently amiss. And perhaps if we're ever going to get to where the overarching vision that some of us have had for 40-some-odd years, that I, maybe in the interim we need to actually begin to do some hard, tough work on what really it would need to take to get us there. When MMIS was mentioned, you know, you and I have been involved and worked on that patchwork for more years than I can count. But I do think, and I think we recognized that this patchwork and stuff is not something that has been good. So I need to put that on the record, because it's just those of you who I think in the interim we need to sit down and actually begin to do some real conscientious work to talk about where we're going to go in the future, so we don't beat this horse to death.
Yes, thank you. Okay, so with this next slide, I want to talk a little bit about the Office of the Information Services and how we're organized. The pie chart...
Kristen, I'm going to stop you just for a second. I want to follow up with Senator Winter's comments. I appreciate this is a very high-level discussion, and I appreciate trying to bring us all to speed. I'm actually a little more concerned about where is the plan and what's the cost to really move these systems into the into the present time. We've got systems out there that they're shopping in Craigslist to find parts for. I talk to caseworkers, and they say, I can do better with my iPhone at home than I can when I've gotten from you at the office. They're totally frustrated. It takes up too much of their time. Both things you're talking about are there. So what I'd like to have you bring to us sooner or later, sooner than later if possible, is some really thoughtful plan over the next 2, 3, 4 years to replace these systems, get them to talk to each other, bring them up to speed, and what the cost of that's going to be, and avoid another cover organ while we're doing it. And you know, I know how difficult this is. I'm deeply involved in the healthcare side of a system called Epic, getting it up to mm-hmm. speed and running properly, and making it work amongst offices. Hello, Susan. And I know this isn't a simple thing to do. I realize that. I appreciate that. But I really want more than this high-level presentation. I would like to see it laid out, what you think you can do, have it, you know, looked at by the IT department or, committee, looked at by LFO, really see what we're going to do here to march this thing forward over the next 2 or 3 biennia and really knock off the stuff first that needs to be done as far as making our caseworkers and others effective. So I appreciate what you're doing here. You know, I was a little frustrated, but it's not with you. It's just I don't hear us getting the nitty-gritty stuff we need to hear about here.
Co-Chair Bates, Senator Winters, certainly both agencies are interested in having that conversation as well, but I want to take the opportunity to be realistic about expectations. If you want in the next couple weeks for us to come and have a conversation about a methodology we could use to create such a plan, Kristen and I could take that assignment and come back and talk with you about a process. If you expect a thoughtful analysis that is a plan that lays out for you in a reasonable way what could actually be replaced in the next couple of years, and you expect us to develop that plan in the next couple of weeks, I can tell you right now, Co-Chair, with all due respect, we won't be able to meet that expectation.
Mr. Chair, that's why I talked about interim. I really think it needs to be thoughtful. I think about the work that we've done with eCourt. eCourt is really rolling out and it's working. Mm-hmm. But, that's not to say that it didn't have bumps and knots on the way. But we've got, if we do not take that thoughtful pathway to begin to address some of these issues, we're constantly talking about problems and breakdowns and legacy systems and MIS systems, and that doesn't work, and a frustrated line staff that's trying to implement this. We will never get to the one-way door.
Co-Chair Bates, Senator Winters, we would welcome that conversation. I think I can say that on behalf of both agencies. We just would like it to be thoughtful.
Yes, and it has to be thoughtful and careful and nimble.
And nimble, yes.
And I think we'll be back here in February, and I would hope you can have something ready for that. Not just for us, it's for you. So you really have a pathway to something that makes sense. I think you're trapped in the classic issue of fighting off alligators. When they're to drain the swamp, you never drain the swamp because you fight with alligators all the time. So really bring us something in February that says, after you've had a chance to think about it, you want this as well as we do, obviously. Lay out a path. Let's do some cost analysis. Let's get everybody involved who needs to be involved. Not me. I don't want to go code. Yeah. I can't make my computer work this morning. I can see the overall picture, okay? Let's get started.
Co-Chair Bates, with all due respect, with the time that's available, can we skip over the overview and problems and opportunities and go straight to set of projects at the end? I think that's the best use of the remaining time. Okay, so now I'm going to take off my DHS hat for a minute, and I'm going to put on my Magi System Transfer Project hat for the Oregon Health Authority. So this slide represents the OHA IT-related projects that are included in the governor's 15-17 budget. These are in-flight projects from 2013-15, the current biennia, that will continue into the next biennia. So I know this committee is well-versed in all of the issues associated with the Cover Oregon Exchange, the attempt to remediate the Oracle framework to make it work for Magi Medicaid eligibility determination in the state, and then the subsequent work to transfer a project. I think you've heard from OHA Director Lynn Saxton, who likes to affectionately call it the March to Kentucky. I, in fact, just got home late last night from Kentucky on another site visit. In general, this project is designed to minimize the amount of actual technology changes. This system operates in Kentucky right now. They have processed more than a million Medicaid eligibility determinations using this system. And so it is not running off somebody's laptop in their mother's basement, but in fact a full-fledged CMS-certified system. We got to the selection of this system using an evaluation process that considered other states' Medicaid programs, believing that if we found a state Medicaid program that was similar to ours, using the technology that enables their program would be the lowest risk strategy for the state. And so Judy Moore Peterson, the state Medicaid director, and I went through an evaluation process where we looked at 10 state systems that were provided to us on recommendation by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and systems that our system integrator had implemented in other states. After we did all of that analysis, turns out we're quite similar to Kentucky. Both states' population just over 4 million. Both states' Medicaid eligibles north of 1.1 million. In fact, ACA expansion for both states put on almost 400,000 people in the Medicaid rolls. Their service delivery model is actually quite similar to ours. The Magi Medicaid system is part of a state-based marketplace. Please let me be clear. We only intend to use the Magi Medicaid eligibility functions out of this system, but we will gather information from Oregonians who come to our front door, and if they are ineligible for Medicaid, we will pass that information to the federal marketplace so that they can search and choose a private health insurance coverage. This project is estimated at the cost you can see here on the slide and is eligible and approved for 90-10 federal funding.
Questions?
On this particular project.
I have some.
Okay.
First off, when you did your analysis and looked into this, who did you bring in from the CCOs to evaluate it with you?
Co-Chair Bates, we did not engage anyone from CCOs.
That's concerning. And that is my question, not theirs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We have an MMIS system this has to talk to, and one of the key parts of the, I assume the key parts of this, is getting these people as they're brought into the system assigned to the proper CCO, and to the proper physician or group in that CCO. You said Kentucky's delivery system is similar to ours. What do they have that is similar to coordinated care organizations in Kentucky?
Co-chair Bates, in fact, the majority of their Medicaid population are in managed care organizations. So there are about 12 managed care organizations that provide Medicaid coverage. The consumer portal, we call the self-service portal of the Kentucky system, will allow a Oregonian to select a CCO if they know. If they don't know or are unable to make a choice, it will pass the enrollment record to MMIS so that the current MMIS process for auto assignment can be done if the customer doesn't make their own choice. And so there are, in fact, you know, care provider screens that will allow you to understand by your geographic area what alternatives exist for you in terms of electing enrollment, and we will pass that information to MMIS. In fact, the Kentucky system also connects to Kentucky's MMIS, and Kentucky's MMIS is based on HP technology. And so, in fact, the amount of interface work that has to be done in order to make the Oregon-specific data connect to the Oregon MMIS is lesser because Kentucky uses an HP MMIS as well. And so much of this cost is associated with making modifications to support enrollment in MMIS.
When an individual goes to enroll through the Kentucky system, whether on their own directly mm-hmm. or with a caseworker or someone helping them, can they see who their provider is going to be? Can they select a provider, not just a CCO, but an actual provider?
So, Co-Chair Bates, the Kentucky system, because it's a full-fledged state-based marketplace, does have a provider search. Our initial implementation of this system will not implement a provider search when we initially go live. It's certainly a conversation that the state Medicaid program is interested in and considering as future functionality, but is not part of what we would do initially. But yes, the answer to your question is the system as implemented in Kentucky allows people to search for individual providers.
So when someone signs up for Medicaid, they have a choice of a CCO, but they don't know what provider they're going to be sent to. And most of them already have a provider. So how is that handled?
Co-Chair Bates, the answer is initially it will not be information that is available in the self-service portal. And so we will have to find additional tools in our toolkit to provide a customer experience to supplement that initially. I don't have an answer to your question here today.
Have you had a discussion with the CCOs if they can be helpful in making this occur?
Co-Chair Bates, certainly the Oregon Health Authority has a CCO advisory committee, and we've just recently had conversations about the project regularly reporting there so that we can begin those dialogues. And so you can absolutely expect that between now and implementation, we will engage them in conversation.
I think you'll find that most people signing up for this program have two key questions. One, do I qualify?
Mm-hmm.
Second one is, can I keep my doctor?
Can I still see my same doctor?
Mm-hmm. Okay, or nurse practitioner or whatever. Mm-hmm. They don't really care what CCO they're in. They don't even know they exist. Okay, they want to know who's my provider. And if you haven't got that functionality, we're going to have a big problem. Because that's what we have with MMIS when it first fired up. And we've got issues there yet. I just see this as a real difficulty in February or so if we don't come up with a solution. So I'm going to ask you to really work with the CCOs on this. Pick four or five of their best tech people, bring them in, have a conversation, see if we can find a way to make this work.
Co-Chair Bates, I'll take that assignment.
Thank you.
Okay, the other two projects listed up here for the Oregon Health Authority for the 2015-2017 biennia, we have Care Assist, which is actually a system that's replacing an existing application for tracking HIV. And then the last one up here is the Office of Health IT Projects, has three projects that we will be working on. One is for Oregon Common Credentialing. This is for centralizing and streamlining the credentialing process for healthcare organizations. The second one listed up here, Provider Directory, is will provide healthcare organizations, providers, and state local agencies in Oregon with an accurate and comprehensive directory for providers. And then the third one, Clinical Quality Metrics Registry, will enable providers and CCOs to submit clinical data for CCO metrics to a central registry.
This next slide represents the new IT-related project investments in the 15-17 governor's budget. The first project we spoke a little bit about, this is a shared policy option package for both the Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Human Services. It's designed to build and implement a tool to collect, report, and analyze real plus D data. Anecdotally, I'll share with the committee that we actually intend to use functionality that is coming as part of the MAGI Medicaid eligibility system, and we're adding real plus D data, or real, because you can't collect disability data elements for people who are applying for health coverage, but the race, ethnicity, and language data elements are being added to the application for Medicaid services, both in the self-service portal and in the back-end worker portal, because once we put the entire Medicaid-eligible population into the new MAGI system, we will have this set of data elements consistently for over a million Oregonians. And so it seems like a way, frankly, to be smart and good public stewards of our dollars of investment and leverage technology rather than to solve each individual policy issue with standalone technology, try to take existing or what will be existing technology and leverage it for other purposes. And so this policy option package supports that work, both from a technology perspective, a data element perspective, and then from a policy perspective in terms of service to Oregonians. The second pop here, you know well because it's been in front of this committee several times, but the Department of Human Services Adult Protective Services IT system, we call Statewide Adult Abuse and Reporting, POP 107. We have recently completed the business case for what the most appropriate alternative is to implement this technology in order to enable the policy legislation that you passed in the last session, asking the department to coordinate adult abuse and reporting. And so this ask supports that policy effort. The third one on this slide is kind of the next to the conversation of the committee earlier, where one-stop shop has been the narration for a long time. And frankly, it's my opinion, at least in the previous version, utilizing Oracle Framework, we promised too much, too big, too fast, and we were not thoughtful in defining explicit scope and implementing pieces of scope that built upon each other like building blocks. Our federal partners at CMS have said that they will extend 90-10 funding for Medicaid eligibility systems, which means after we do income-based Medicaid or MAGI eligibility, the most sense to leverage the greatest amount of federal investment is to replace the eligibility system for non-income or non-MAGI eligibility. And so we have submitted a request for planning and initial implementation dollars in our federal fiscal year 15 request, and that has been approved to the level of $7.5 million. And so I think it's the agency's intent to try and do the appropriate stage gate work so that we could come back in February, having completed analysis, having completed a business case, and seek permission to begin to implement, because we will have finished the MAGI implementation at that point. So with that, I think we'd like to just pause and answer any questions you might have about particular projects.
I think you've stunned us all. One of our problems here is we probably don't have the knowledge, the depth of knowledge, really need to sometimes make decisions on these, and we should admit that to ourselves. We learned a terrible lesson with cover organ on that.
Sure.
I don't know how to write code. I don't know how to analyze large systems of this nature. It's out of the realm of my expertise. And so we depend on other people to give us their best estimate of what's going on.
Sure.
We would only ask that you do that, and we don't fall into another Cover Oregon trap. We have systems in place that hopefully will not allow that to happen again.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the questions I posed to you earlier today makes me a little concerned. The lack of CCO involvement in the march to Kentucky, not having the function of being able to directly line up an individual with a provider. These are key questions for a system and cause systems to fail. Our previous efforts have led to some bizarre things of patients being assigned to doctors 50, 60, 70 miles away when they've had a 25-year relationship with one doctor. it happens over and over again with CCOs not being certain of who they have enrolled, and not being able to track the cost of those individuals, and not being able to pay their bills. So I would really ask you to get very involved with our partners. I think they can be helpful to you. At least I hope they can be. I know it can be a strain sometimes to do that.
Co-Chair Bates, certainly it is not for lack of desire, and you know, certainly I take your ask very seriously. Personally, I know Judy Moore Peterson, who is business lead on the project. That's how seriously we take the successful implementation of this project. Is we've asked the state Medicaid director to spend the majority of her FTE making sure that we get this system right from a policy and business process perspective, and so I hear your concerns, and we will work on them, and we will report back the progress that we're making on addressing those specifically. You should get to depend on people like Kristen and I to come and lay out for you thoughtful plans that are specific, that are limited in scope, that have defined milestones, that have appropriate oversight. You have the right to expect that from us, because that's the way that system work should be done. I think partially in our organizations, a bunch of my responsibility, at least for the Department of Human Services, is to make the agency be a better customer of technology service providers. We need to do a better job defining up front what we want and articulating that in a way that people like Kristen's organization or third-party vendors can actually deliver on it, so that everyone has appropriate expectations set, and then we're all collectively held accountable to those expectations. You shouldn't have to be experts. We should do a better job of delivering that information for you. And you should have your people who have frankly been good partners to us. I spend an hour with Mr. Cummings every other week talking about the specifics of oversight of the MAGI Medicaid project. And, you know, we have a monthly meeting, Kristen and I, together with Mr. Cummings and representatives from the state CIO's office talking about the total portfolio of projects. And so we are deeply committed to making sure your professional staff have the information that they need to advise you on the credibility of the information that we're providing. And you have right to have expectation, and we should be accountable to those expectations.
Well, you realize that's not been the experience of this committee in the last few years.
I certainly understand that that's the place that we're starting from. I hope, Co-Chair Bates, in 2 years you're saying, you finally delivered for these set of agencies on something that you promised this committee. That's the conversation I hope we're having in 2 years.
I'd love to have that conversation. Senator Winters?
We just need to add, because I think in the subject that has been raised by the good senator, it's beyond just Cover Oregon. This body has kind of, when you say IT projects, become extremely, extremely, extremely nervous.
Sure.
To the point where I think even getting the votes for things on IT becomes extremely problematic in this building.
Sure.
So the advice from the good senator is extremely important when you talk about making certain that, you know, Mr. Cummings and others have put their stamp on it. We do not. I know personally, I do not want to go forward and endorse any future IT projects unless all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. And that also, that includes, as was pointed out, the engagement and work of the provider groups. They have a big stake in what we do in this building, and so often, you know, we're working here and forgetting about the delivery there. So I just had to add to what the good senator, has advised, and I'm sure that the other good co-chair also feels the same kind of thing.
Co-Chair Bates, Senator Winters, we certainly share that. I mean, you both probably don't know, my previous job, right, was a deputy chief operating officer for all of state government at the Department of Human Services. I was deeply involved in the conceptualization of the Enterprise IT Governance Committee and the work that we have done to increase our standards of accountability across state agencies. So I come with that fire to this particular job, and in partnership with Kristen for both organizations. We both are deeply committed to making sure that Dr. Alex Petta is successful in raising the standards on the executive branch side to be able to make sure that projects are accountable and have the appropriate amount of analysis. Because you know what? It's not just for an oversight purpose. Doing the right things to frame up the projects helps make sure that we actually understand what we're undertaking and increases the likelihood we'll be successful in it. And so, preaching to the choir.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're getting the benefit of having seen a state system that works as we transfer our exchange to Kentucky. Are there other states that are making headway on the one-stop shopping, one-stop portal?
Co-Chair Bates, Representative Kenny Geyer, yes. In fact, many of the systems that we looked at have integrated eligibility components. And in fact, I can say, because the purpose of my visit to Kentucky this week was to look at their upcoming release in this December, which is integrated eligibility for non-MAGI Medicaid programs in Kentucky, also for SNAP and TANF programs in Kentucky. So I think, you know, my agency head would say we all use integrated eligibility sort of really loosely, and what does that actually mean in terms of service to the client? But certainly this platform has at least the possibility of becoming foundational. I don't think we have presupposed that the next version of the Kentucky release is necessarily right, because we haven't done a good enough job of defining our business needs and matching the functionality that they're producing against that. But we're starting to make technology decisions that don't put roadblocks in the way for use by future programs, right? So every time we have a technology decision to implement as it relates to the MAGI project, we say, if we do it this way, can we use it for other programs? If the answer to that is yes, then we try to make that choice every time so as to create a foundation. So I, you know, I mean, certainly I can name for you states that integrate portions of systems, but most states tend to put all of their medical-related programs together and then all of their subsidy-related programs together. Very few states have figured out how to cross the chasm. Kentucky appears to be leading in that case. And their implementation of that policy will happen at the same time we're bringing up our first MAGI system.
It's hopeful.
Thank you. Any other questions? Do you have anything else to offer to the committee? Because I have no problem leaving early.
Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, we're going to say thank you and go.
And I will tell you that the proof for the pudding is going to be in the eating. So we'll see what comes out of all this, okay?
Yep.
Thank you. And thank you for your time, and I appreciate your
appreciate efforts. The time of the committee.
No subcommittee meeting on Monday.
Well, there's no meeting on Monday, is there? Okay, good. There's no meeting on Monday, is there? Okay, good.